Right, well, our title for this morning's passage is Live in Awe. Live in Awe. And it's to do with the interrelationship between behavior and belief. And it's a very important issue for a number of reasons, and I'll explain why. A certain kind of understanding about God should inspire a certain kind of lifestyle. That's the main theme which is being dealt with here. And it's very important. It's very important because it's the issue, sadly, where Christians all over the world are at their weakest. It's where the crack shows most clearly, the gap between belief and behavior. I think you know this to be true. So often the way we live denies in practice what we believe. And unfortunately in these situations, the critics of Christianity have a field day, and we probably deserve it. It's not just the Sun newspaper or the media, it's the people who are closest to us. They are the ones who watch us. Because as Christians, we live before a watching world. It's the people in our office or our work, the non-Christians at home, those in our inner circle who are not Christians. They are watching us. And indeed, they may well want to know what it is that we believe and why and what we stand for. But I think you can be absolutely sure of one thing. They can smell a phony a mile off. And it's our responsibility to close the gap between behavior and belief and bring integrity to our lifestyle and what we proclaim about Christ and our commitment to Him. Our witness depends on it. So that's the overall topic. But it's the thesis or the diagnosis of this particular problem as it's spelled out in Hebrews, which is the really fascinating issue here. The Hebrew Christians of the first century were just as guilty as we are of hypocritical, substandard Christian living. And by consequence, their witness, like ours, was becoming tame and eroded and even ineffective. But, and this is the thing I want you to note, the writer puts it down not to their laziness or their apathy, first of all, although such things were involved, but he sees the major failing is to do with something in a way far deeper. The major failing is to do with a blunted vision of God. A way of seeing God daily, which does far less than justice to the full truth about Him as we know it, revealed in Christ and the Scripture. It is, in a word, failing to live in awe. And this suggests one vital implication. If our sense of the awe of God diminishes, so will our sense of inspiration to serve Him. It is our vision of God, our sense of awe, which includes our love, our gratitude, but also our sense of His surpassing greatness, His majesty and His splendor, which makes the tie-up between behavior and belief truly effective. And that tie-up between behavior and belief affects our witness, and it affects it radically. So as you see, it's a very powerful approach indeed to putting into practice what we believe. I hope you're clear about the topic and the diagnosis. If you are, we'll go straight into the text now and see how the writer works all this out. So could you turn over one page to page 212? I'd like us to have a look at the very last words of the chapter. Chapter 12, verses 28 and 29. We'll pick up the second half of verse 28. We're on page 212. Let me read them to you. Thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Those words come at the end of the passage. But that, in fact, is the dominant thought of the whole of that chapter. Let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. I have just a quick thought about worship, because it's important in the context. The worship which is referred to there, as the context makes clear, is mainly to do with lifestyle, the way we live before God. Now, the New Testament, as you know, often uses the word worship in this wider sense. It doesn't refer to the singing of hymns or a church service in particular here. It is making the strong point, by contrast, that the whole of our lives, the whole of our lives, are of interest to God. That everything we are and everything that we do could and should be part of our worship
before God.
It's the same way, as you know, that Paul uses this idea in Romans 12:1. I appeal to you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, wherein is your spiritual worship. Okay? The idea of worship includes the whole of our lives, not here particularly to do with singing or church services. We'll move on. I want you to notice now this very striking phrase that the writer uses to describe God. It's in verse 29 at the end. Our God is a consuming fire. And so the consequence, we must offer to him acceptable worship with reverence and awe. A consuming fire. I wonder whether that is the way that you would choose personally to describe God. We have to ask ourselves the question, why does the writer choose to use this very expressive and strong term about God? Our God is a consuming fire. What impact is that meant to make upon us? It is a very strong description, so we should ask why. Everything else in this whole passage depends upon that description of God. Having said that, I'm going to leave the question hanging in the air, if you don't mind. I simply wanted to raise the issue in your mind, bamboozle you a little bit, get you thinking, so that we can see the whole of the passage in relationship to this thought, and then we'll return to it later at the end. It's time to have a closer look now at the structure and the content of the whole passage. So, we're going to aim to work out some of the implications and the teaching for our own lives and situations. So we're going to look at verse 12, back on page 211. Now just look down the page there, and you'll see that the passage in the RSV, if you're following in the Revised Standard Version, that it splits neatly into three paragraphs, beginning on verse 12, and then verse 18, and then verse 25. And those three paragraphs split up the division of the argument very helpfully, and I think very accurately. So I'm going to take, if I may, each paragraph in turn, taking separately for those paragraphs these headings for each section. These are my headings. Three responsibilities, two worlds, one consequence. Three responsibilities, two worlds, one consequence. Those are the headings for each of the paragraphs. I think it's the natural breakdown of the passage. So we'll take verses 12 to 17 as a paragraph, as a block in its own right. And the heading, three responsibilities. And we'll look at each part in turn. So verses 12 and 13. Therefore lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Three responsibilities. Number one, responsibility for yourself. Do I need to remind you that it's very easy for us to become despondent, especially when things do not go our own way? I think we hardly need reminding of that. It's obvious. But the danger with despondency is that it can produce inertia within us. And when inertia sets in, we can begin to lose our direction, we lose our energy, and we lose our sense of purpose. We become sluggish, and we become disheartened. This is a fairly trivial example, but I'm quite sure you also have days when things go completely wrong. The bank holiday last Monday was a bit like that for me. The evening was lovely, as it happened, because we went out to supper. But during the day, everything went wrong which could have gone wrong, culminating in some kindly local thug smashing in the back window of our car and stealing my briefcase. Now, no sympathy is required because I got my briefcase back eventually and we cleared up the mess of the broken glass and it was all right. Actually, all the things which happened were small and relatively trivial. But by Monday afternoon, I was feeling so tired and so despondent, I felt like packing up for the rest of the day and doing precisely nothing. I'm sure you've felt like that from time to time, probably pretty often. The inertia sets in, doesn't it? Of course it was daft, but I felt pretty sorry for myself. And all that was fairly inconsequential stuff. You see, if we let them, our emotions exert a pretty powerful hold upon us. Now take a more serious situation. Some of you have had real cause for despondency just recently. I know that for some of you the catalogue of pressures upon you has been considerable. There's been discouragement and difficulty. and pain and illness. It's been an uphill struggle. Some of you are wrestling with deep inward problems, and some of you I know are saying to yourselves, I cannot face it any longer. I think I've had enough. It is very easy to become despondent when things do not go our own way, especially when the real pressures come. But the danger with despondency is that it brings inertia. It saps our vision of God and His purposes for us. We look inwards instead of upwards and outwards, and gradually we grind slowly to a halt. The enthusiasm, the inspiration, the zeal that we had goes straight out of the window, and it's more than feeling sorry for ourselves. Inertia sets in and we become ineffective at the very point where there is most potential for growth. Now I wonder whether you are in that situation. Whether your troubles are relatively trivial and slight, or whether they are deeply disquieting and a tremendous burden to you, the danger of despondency is the same. It leads to inertia. And it is precisely to those who are going through this experience of despondency to whom these words in this passage in Hebrews are addressed. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Do you know that every problem, every difficulty, every struggle for us as Christians carries within it the potential for growth, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. So we have to guard against despondency, whether our troubles are light or burdensome. None of us are ever going to be immune from trouble of one kind or another. We cannot avoid it. We have to learn to face it and to accept it as coming, sometimes mysteriously, in the good purposes of God for us. As the first part of this chapter, chapter 12, actually suggests, God does permit such things, not to hurt us, but to aid us in our growth in maturity as His children. Number one, responsibility. It is for ourselves not to sink into despondency and its consequence of inertia, but to keep our vision clear and our commitment strong. Responsibility for ourselves. The number two responsibility is for our relationships. I'd like you to have a look at verse 14. Strive for peace with all men, and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Responsibility for our relationships. We've been shown the trap, haven't we, of becoming overwhelmed by the difficulties that we face in life, of sinking into inertia. We have to be purposeful and get on with it. I think it's fascinating that attention is now immediately drawn to the question of relationships. It is in our relationships where we discover the most upsetting conflicts that we experience in life, and sadly in our stupidity we contribute liberally to those conflicts only too often. So we have to take seriously our responsibility in relationships. Verse 14 is a very strong expression in the Greek. Strive for peace. Strive for peace with all men. And I'd like you to notice this very important theological link between peace and holiness. Strive for peace with all men, and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Holiness means becoming more like God, committing yourself to do His will, to His way of doing things. It means desiring to become more like Christ. All right, how then do holiness and peace link up, especially in this area of relationships? Maybe you're facing a problem in a relationship of some kind. We all go through that. Maybe there's someone who is continually rubbing you up the wrong way. Somebody in the family, perhaps. Somebody with whom you work. Someone who goads you, or whose attitudes or actions are to you like a red rag to a bull. They make you boil. You put your hand up if there's someone here who's never felt like that, sometime or other. Yeah, well, I thought so. So what can we do about it when we feel like that? Maybe you've tried. But the argument or the anger that's going on within you continually gets the better of you. You tried and you failed and you failed and you failed again. And of course, it is dispiriting when things are like that. It can make you despondent. Worse, inertia can set in. And you simply learn through inertia, through that continuing discouragement, to accept the aggro as a normal part of your life, and you end up by doing precisely nothing about the aggro, the painful relationships, the pain within. So what's the clue to it all? How do you make a step forward? Well, the clue is this link between peace and holiness. When we strive for holiness in our lives, bringing our lives into willing conformity with God's purposes, then a practical way of peace is so much more practical for us. I want to try and explain this a little more fully so that we all get the point. One cause of conflict between us is to do with our sensitivities, our inner sensitivities, our inner hurts and our soreness. We all know, don't we, that under the surface of our lives lurk all kinds of personal sensitivities. They're the baggage of our lives that we carry around with us from childhood to adolescence and into our adulthood. We're all very, very sensitive underneath the surface. No one is accepted. Now the problem comes when someone steps on one of our most cherished inner pains. And inwardly, sometimes the reaction is far more than ouch. You see, those inner sensitivities become threatened. They become threatened by someone else's words or actions, or simply by what they stand for, or even by the memory of words or attitudes or actions of things now past. And what happens? Well, I'll tell you what happens. We rush to the defense of our sensitive inner selves. We wave our own words around like offensive weapons. And then the words which we wave around make things really worse. The sparks fly upwards. Acrimony becomes the order of the day. There isn't one person here who is immune from that. So how can we as Christians counteract this weakness within ourselves? Be encouraged. There is a way forward, and it is to do with holiness. When we give up our lives to Christ and more seek for holiness, we give God a chance to heal these inner sensitivities of ours by actually letting him in to our bruised inner selves. It's a little bit like removing a plaster and exposing a wound to the fresh air and letting it heal in the open. And we have to do that. We have to open our lives fully to God and let him touch the painful parts of our lives, the parts where there is resentment and hurt, the areas where there's a real need for change on our part, to do with attitudes, to do with expectations, and our need to forgive fully and deeply and unreservedly. Because our relationships matter, especially with the people who have wronged us. We need to put right the attitudes within ourselves. You cannot nurse that anger forever. It will get the better of you in the end. How do we find a way out? Jesus' forgiveness enables us to forgive those who have hurt or wronged us. We live before a watching world. People do look to the way that we handle our relationships. And it's there they question whether Christianity works or not. And it's as basic as that. This is the way to live and to please God and show other people the reality of Christ. So it is a serious issue. And knowledge of this equation is important. The quality of our relationships with each other is dependent on our relationship with God. If holiness comes first, you will be enabled to pursue the way of peace in your dealings with others. You try it. Now don't mistake me, I'm like anybody else. There are times when I get ratty and unpleasant around the house. Try and keep it to the minimum, actually. But I can tell you, when I do slip, those are the times when I have become spiritually slovenly. It's true.
You neglect God and his righteousness,
and your relationships suffer. Holiness keeps us on course. It enables us to work at peace in our relationships. It liberates us inwardly because we are making room for God in our lives. I do hope you've got that. Responsibility for ourselves, responsibility for our relationships, and number three, responsibility for others. This is verses 15 to 17, and we'll read just part of that. Verse 15. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness spring up and cause trouble, and by it the many become defiled, that no one be immoral or irreligious like Esau. We have responsibility for one another. As we've seen so far, the overall concern of the passage is Christian lifestyle, closing that gap between behavior and belief. And we have responsibility for each other to help one another know the grace of God in our lives. And this is the wider responsibility, not for the specific relationships of home, work, and friendships, which we've just looked at, but our general responsibility for all Christians, and especially members of our own church and our own church family. There used to be an awful evangelical syndrome, and I suspect it may be still around. It goes something like this. You bump into another Christian at church, you smile broadly, and out comes the conditioned reflex, how are you? Fine, is the sometimes less than honest reply. And one goofy grin later, and off you go again, singing your chorus happily under your breath. Your lives, not having touched. Mind you, the excesses of sincerity can be just as bad. How are you? The eyes are fixed on yours. Very well, thank you. But how are you really? So you recognize it. Now, of course, it's just a caricature. But unfortunately, in any social situation, and especially in churches, extremes are always dangerously present. In our case, shallow insincerity or nosy paternalism. I simply want to ask you this. How much do you care? How much do you care about the people in your church? How much do you care about the people in this church? How much do you care about Christians? How much do you care about Christians in your place of work or study? Do you care? Do you care about how other Christians are doing? Whether they're under pressure, whether they're struggling, whether they're discouraged, whether they are despondent. Because it is our role to encourage each other, not by hearty slaps on the back. For us as Christians, encouragement comes in two much more profound ways, by love and by prayer. Think about love. In order to love a person, you have to give time to them. You cannot love without time spent. Love is far more than a feeling. Love expressed requires the expenditure of time. So, we mustn't skimp on the amount of time that we spend with people. We all need encouraging. We all need encouraging spiritually. We need to be listened to. We need to be loved, all of us. That, of course, includes me as well as you. So, what is wrong? What is wrong with all souls at the moment? When so many of us seem to be charging around, spreading ourselves as thin as can be, how can we even find time to pray for each other when there's not really time to connect in a real way with each other's lives? Think about it. You and I have three responsibilities. To ourselves, to our relationships, and to other Christians, especially within the church family. And you cannot duck any one of them. And if you do, the crack begins to open up between behavior and belief. So beware of the sin of diversification. Don't do too much. Don't become too busy. Don't spread yourself too thin. If you do, the consequence is inevitable. First, you'll suffer. Then, your relationships will suffer. And then, the church will suffer.
You do need to work at all three for the world to see the changed lives which Jesus Christ makes possible. It is to do with responsibilities, a strong word. Like the comparison with Esau in the passage, either our concerns come first or God's concerns come first. And we have to ask ourselves quite simply, which is it going to be? We are moulded by our choices, and you can put yourself first once too often. And the passage does warn us, it's clear. If you do that, if you do let that happen, then you put yourself at risk. You put yourself at risk of falling out of the race altogether. Something to think about. From those three responsibilities, we turn more briefly now to verses 18 to 24, to the two worlds. The two worlds. We often speak about someone being highly motivated or goal-orientated, having real direction in life. And it makes all the difference in the end. When I was a music student some years ago, I used to be fascinated by the piano writing of the Hungarian composer Franz Liszt. Liszt, as you probably know, was the greatest piano virtuoso of the 19th century, probably of all time. And his piano writing, particularly the Transcendental Etude, is the most ingenious, creative, virtuosic, and technically demanding piano writing in the literature. It is really quite stupendous, phenomenally difficult to play, and most imaginative. This man Liszt was highly goal-orientated. I want to tell you about something which happened to him early in his career. Liszt was the pupil of Czerny. Czerny is that man who wrote those awful five-figure exercises. Da 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 da. See, many of you have suffered. Well, Czerny was, you might be surprised to know, with that bit of musical ingenuity before us, Czerny had been a pupil of Beethoven. Now, one day, the young Franz Liszt heard the legendary violinist Paganini. Paganini was an extraordinarily remarkable man. He was an extraordinarily remarkable violinist himself. They used to say that he was in league with the devil because, again, he was a most phenomenal virtuoso. And there's never been, again, on the violin a virtuoso like him. Now, Liszt was bowled over by this. It's perfectly true. Liszt was so bowled over by Paganini's playing that when he heard him, he resolved there and then to turn his back on the past, the world of Beethoven and Czerny, and to recreate on the piano the fantastic virtuosity and ingenuity and brilliance that Paganini had displayed on the violin. And he worked at it all his life. The remarkable Transcendental Etudes were the result. And they are really, I can tell you, I studied them and couldn't play them. They're really staggering. Now, Liszt knew what he wanted to do. He had his goals set out. He knew where he was going. In a spiritual sense, we need to have our goals mapped out too. We need to know where we are going. And here in these verses, there are two possible worlds to work towards. One is in the past, and one is in the future. The world of the past is verses 18 to 21. It's the world of Moses, the world of the giving of the law. Now just cast your minds back to this background history of Hebrews. Hebrew Christians were harking back, weren't they? They were harking back all the time. But the past is not relevant, not in terms of goals, not as something to work towards. Our motivation can never be the past. It must always be in the future. Now the point that the passage is making quite simply is that the Hebrew Christians didn't have any goals mapped out. They didn't have any sense of working towards a future which is entirely within the purposes of God. That, by contrast, is the point of verses 22 to 24. You notice the implication of verse 22. You have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God. And what does that mean? It means this. You and I have become incorporated into God's kingdom. We're part of his people, and we're working towards a goal. Lose sight of the goal, and you immediately loosen the relationship between belief and behavior. Those three responsibilities of self, relationships, and others don't matter so much if there's no future to seriously consider. You have nothing to work towards. So, question. Which world are you working towards? Are you taking the risks of faith, because they are risks, which are a necessary part of working towards the future with God? Or are you more preoccupied with the past? I'll bet, if I was a betting man, which I'm not, I put a lot of money that there are a lot of you are aiming towards the past. You're nursing past hurts, past anger, past cares. You need to look towards the future. Our priorities need a regular check-up. Again, if you let yourself be too busy, your vision of God, becomes stifled. And this brings us to the final paragraph. Back to the original question. Why describe God as a consuming fire in the first place? Verses 25 to 29. Three responsibilities, two worlds, and finally, one consequence. Let's turn over the page and go back to verses 28 and 29. Thus, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. One consequence. Fire, as you know, in Scripture is often the visual aid of God's holiness, like, for instance, the fire of the burning bush or the fire at Sinai. May I ask you another question? What is your vision of God? Do you have before your mind the blazing heat of God's holiness, his justice, his righteousness, his love? Do you know that he burns so much with care for us, he sent Jesus Christ to die for us so that we could become his children? Do you realize that this God is a consuming fire? This God who is a consuming fire, you are the child of. This God cares passionately about you, about the way you live, about the way you contribute to his kingdom, the way you treat yourself, your relationships, other Christians, before a watching world. Your God is a consuming fire. And my friends, he burns with ferocious anger when that crack opens up between behavior and belief. Because it means we have lost our vision. We have lost our vision of God, of the future, and our part in it. And the world around us notices it. Three responsibilities, two worlds, one consequence. Thus, let us offer to God acceptable worship, the worship of our lives, with reverence and with awe. Why? Why? You and I are together members of this church, All Souls, Langham Place. Looking out from Oxford Circus, next door to Broadcasting House. We have as high a visibility as any single church in the country, probably in Europe. And when visitors come in here and they meet us and they look at the quality of our lives, individually and together, they should be deeply, deeply, deeply impressed. They should be able to say, Jesus Christ actually makes a difference. This should be their conclusion. What they believe, they actually live out. And that witness is our responsibility. So as we conclude, what part are you playing in that difference? Is it true of you? Go back to your vision of God. We need to live in awe. Our friends, our families, those we work with, they do watch us. They can smell a phony a mile off. Have you a blunted vision of God? Our God is a consuming fire, and we must therefore narrow the gap between behavior and belief. Let's be quiet together. words of this part of Scripture are powerful and speak to us in different ways, I suggest we take a few moments of silence so that we can pray personally and quietly for ourselves.